Now, let me see, what is it? It's 17 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. And if you watched the Oscars last week, you'll have noticed that when the final winner of the evening was called out for Best Picture, it's the film's producers who actually get the coveted statuettes. But what exactly does the producer of a movie do? What does their job involve, other than going up on the stage at the Oscars if they're lucky enough to win? Well, I've got two men in front of me here who know the answer to that. If they don't, we're up the Swanee, I'll tell you. Ed Guiney, come on, Ed, co-founder and company director of Element Pictures, produced well-known Irish films including What Richard Did, Garage, Adam and Paul, The Guard, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, etc. Gareth Daly, come on, Gareth. Morning. Managing Director of Film and Television Production Company Mixed Bag Media. And most recently, he wrote, directed and produced. You're already telling him to do something and not do something. That's cheating, God's sake. Did I say the wrong name? Did I? Sorry, Gareth, yeah. Anyway, where are we? The critically acclaimed Nightingale Falling and set you in the War of Independence. Now, getting a film made is what I want to look at here. How shall I put this, first of all? How do you actually become a producer, first of all? I mean, don't tell me at the age of 8 you didn't want to be driving a fire truck or something. I wanted to be a producer. Or is that the way it was, Ed?
Actually, weirdly enough, it was like that for me. When I was a kid, I used to love reading biographies of Hollywood studio kind of legends, like the old Mayers and Thalbergs and all those guys.
These are the guys with big fat cigars and two balls on either side.
Yeah, some of them weren't, exactly. And so you wonder why a 16-year-old boy would be fascinated by that. I don't know, I wonder why. But and I decided I wanted to be a producer when I was about 16, 17. I didn't really know what a producer did, but I wanted to be one. And I went about it, basically.
And Gareth, you did the same thing, did you, or did you not? I mean, like, can you go to study this, and is it a good idea to go and study, which Ed sounds like he didn't do, except for reading the books?
I did. I mean, I went the film school route, and I ended up in the UK in the Northern Media School in Sheffield. And I remember sort of the first day when I was there, it was quite a good school because they gave us budgets to make films. So there was quite a realistic aspect to it. But we were introduced to our desk and our phone at the time, an empty desk. Mm. And that was sort of the beginning of it, because I remember, I mean, there was no internet in those days. So you were just sort of, there you go, off you go and produce. So we had to sort of face it straight away. And I quickly realized what it was, what the job entailed, which was just building relationships through this phone and basically starting to organize people to get together and, working from nothing and then beginning with the script and finding a way to do it. So I suppose I learned on the job in film school, yeah. And then I realised that I liked making movies, and from there decided that I was going to try and, pursue a career in it.
I mean, to me, the producer and director was always, the director is the guy on the set doing the thing every day, looking at the thing he's done, say, let's do another take and all this kind of thing, and shouting through a megaphone or whatever it happens to be. That was the director. And to me, the producer was the guy who got the money together. Now, that seems to be not necessarily totally the case, so we'll get to that in a second, but I would imagine that in terms of studying and going to film school and all the rest of it, that if you went to legal school, that's a huge kind of amount of the people involved in what you do, that's where they come from.
I think, yeah, I mean, looking back at it now, I kind of think I wish I had done a legal degree, I wish I had more financial experience, because in some ways you learn on the job doing it, and that wasn't as much a part of it. You know, it's very much kind of indie film school, because you're more line producing, I think, than you are anything else, because you're putting together stuff like sorting out accommodation for crew, you're
Is the line producer the kind of the money day-to-day person more than the producer?
It's more the running, setting up deals with production houses for where you might edit, looking after sort of day-to-day aspects on the set. But, I mean, they'll tell you that a producer will do absolutely everything. I mean, they're first on the film and they're last off it.
Yeah.
But what you have in between, I suppose, is a whole mixture of different titles, from executive producer, co-producer. That's, I think, where it starts to get confusing. I mean, there was 41 producers on The Butler, that movie, which is quite an extraordinary number.
I saw the movie. Yeah,
when you
didn't
think of it,
realize
six,
that, yeah.
16 on The King's Speech.
Really?
And I suppose when you see the, you're talking about the Oscars and everybody going up to accept their award, you're thinking, what are all those people? Car crash, I think Harvey Weinstein described it as, the award car crash. And I think after 1999, Shakespeare in Love, five people went up and they all did speeches, and the Academy at that stage says, hang on, we can't be having this. It's just dragging on.
The Academy
it's not good
are right.
For television.
Yeah.
And they are right.
Yeah.
So they had to sort of call it and say, look, only people that were directly involved with the production, know, involved in casting, if they were on the set freezing in the middle of the night, they deserve to be there.
I think that's good enough. All right, Gareth, listen to you, Ed, just the same way with you, is it the same kind of thing? Like he said, Gareth said, learning on the job. From your point of view, you really didn't have much of a clue what you were necessarily doing, even though pretty soon on, when you were in college, you and Lenny Abrahamson set up a video production society. Even then, you were kind of, I don't necessarily know what I'm doing, but I know I'm not into the judo society or something, so I might as well do this.
Yeah, I mean, that was really how it was. I mean, I decided to exactly that, set up a video production society, and I knew Lenny, like I knew him. In fact, I dated his sister. That's how I knew Lenny when I was in school. And so I phoned him up and we set up this video production society, and we made some terrible things. You know, it was kind of little documentaries. We made a documentary about the Trinity Ball, which is appalling and hopefully has been lost. We also made a film, I remember, about Lenny's grandfather, who was a refugee who came to Ireland and opened a butcher shop on Clanbrassil Street, which was actually probably the best thing we did. Yeah. We did that with our friend Stephen Renix, who writes all the music for Lenny's films. So we just, I mean, that's what, you know, when people ask me about it or how you get into it, that's the thing I always say, is just like, go and do something. You know, it's kind of, it's so easy now, and it's so much easier now.
But there was a little bit of help in your brain saying, I know I can't do directing.
I wasn't drawn to it. I don't know why, honestly. I just didn't have an instinct that I was drawn to it. I was like, I think the thing that's nice about producing is that you kind of get to work with, you know, quite a lot of different projects, a lot of different people, whereas directing is very monofocused. Like, once you're on a movie, once it starts, you know what I mean? Once you're kind of actually making it, you're on it for, like, 12 months, 18 months.
And are there much more things in place now to make it easier these days? Is that what you mean?
Like, for directors or producers? Yeah, but what I mean by a director being on it is that's all you do. Like, you have to deliver that film.
Yeah,
you know, that's basically what you have to do.
All right, so, like, how much of the job then is about the money and the budgets that I mentioned earlier on? Like, you know, how important is it to be financially minded? I mean, Gareth, you're more or less saying that you wish you'd done a bit more of the legal or a bit more of the money or whatever, but do you need to be more? Or do you, in the last few years, do you realise, I better get my shit together with this?
I mean, I did a ESS course in Trinity, and the reason I did it was because it was 8 hours a week.
A what course?
It was like an economic, a business studies degree in Trinity, right. And the reason I did it was because it was so few hours. That's why I chose it. I didn't choose it particularly because, I mean, it was 8 hours of lectures a week, so I thought, oh, that's great. I can go to college. I can do lots of other things at the same time.
Yeah.
And actually, in a way, I regret not doing like drama in English or languages or something like that. That would be more useful to me because, I mean, yes, of course, raising money and managing budgets is part of it, but it's only part of it, you know? Like, I suppose, in a way, the thing that distinguishes producers, that makes the world want to work with you, is your talent relationships. I mean, you were saying that earlier. It's all about your relationships. So what I bring to bear is, you know, being able to say to a financier, here's a script, here's an actor, here's a director, here's a price, we'll make it for you, and I will deliver it in the best possible version of that to you, basically.
Right.
So it's kind of, I mean, sounds dry, but it's kind of project management as well. You know, that's a big part of it. But also then you're dealing with the kind of, the detail of that. Like, if you go and you look at a rough cut of a film and it's like 3 hours long and you're supposed to be delivering a 90-minute film and the guy who's directed it is telling you he thinks it's brilliant in 3 hours, well, then you have an issue there that you need to resolve.
And that happens all the time.
Well, it happens more. It does happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, it's I don't know, it's personal relationships, it's management.
Okay, but Gareth, if you break it down in terms of just what we were talking about there, there are two different types of producers, really, in some ways. There's the creative producer and the financial one, and that's kind of how it works. There's your producer and your line producer.
Well, I mean, trying to access money to get it going is very difficult, and Ed would have a lot more experience in that field than me.
We're talking two things here. People with loads of money and the film board.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ireland hasn't got a huge amount of choices in terms of where you can access money because, say, if you are turned down by the film board, you need to find someone with a lot of money who's going to finance your dream, probably, to make a movie.
Yeah.
So there's not too many other places to go. And even at that, the amount of money that they can give would still be very small. I mean, they probably have an annual budget just under 13 million, which is tiny if you think about it in terms of, you know, larger scale movies that are coming from other countries. So you don't have a huge amount of options. You have a co-production option as well, because Ireland would have an agreement with other countries such as Luxembourg in terms of, you know, sourcing money from these areas. And that makes the process quite long. It makes it long for producers because they don't have access to ready-made money to go to a studio to say, can we have 50 million to make a movie? And what happens is they'll end up going to all these different areas to access small pockets of 2 million, 3 million.
Yeah, yeah.
This is how it can take so long to make a movie.
Good in someone who's bad at big and small, for instance, like Roger Corman was over here and he made loads of movies in the west of Ireland, would he have been good, would you say, in terms of the end product with a budget, a tiny budget? And who's good with a huge budget? What I mean, like, we're talking big budget movies here.
Well, I mean, he's good at the bottom line. That's the thing. You know, all those movies made money because they were made for a specific market. So he knew they weren't going to have theatrical releases. Sure. Who's good at doing the bigger budgets? I mean, you know, the studios in the States only make about probably 12 big tentpole movies every year. And, you know, they finance them to the degree that there's so much money involved and they open on such a wide scale that they will return quite good money. I mean, Transformers was critically smashed around the world. It earned over $1 billion at the box office. And like there was about, I think, 150 million put into publicity on that movie. I mean, what would we do with 150 million in this
country?
So
what's the title of this essay? There's no accounting for taste.
There's no, nobody knows anything in the words of William Goldman.
Exactly.
I think,
Yeah. But I mean, like, again, like, you know, the actor kind of situation, isn't that done? Our Irish actor very good, that movie, in terms of his next step and all the rest, Jack and all the rest. Okay, now, what about with you guys too? I mean, like, with that, with the kind of money that happens in terms of big movies and all the rest of that, doesn't an awful lot of that percentage go to some bloody guy who doesn't deserve it because he's the main actor and he can open the movie?
Well, I mean, it's part of the, it's just the way that, the way the world works, because you want people to come and see your movie. And also the other thing that I didn't realise about great actors or actors stars is a lot of the time they're brilliant. I mean, you know, in a way there's this kind of fallacy that people think, oh, you just lucked out and you kind of, it could have been any number of people. But an awful lot of them are very clever and they're really good actors, you know, so, and it's incredibly competitive to get there. So they are very rare, and, you know, in this world you pay a lot for things that are very rare.
You're just hoping that Michael Fassbender is listening and say, oh, I'll do Ed's movie. Oh, wait a minute, he has done your movie. I forgot.
But the other thing that's true, though, is there's also a kind of, there's two economies for actors as well. Like, actors understand that, like, you get paid the big bucks on the big Hollywood tentpole movies, but they will then still come back here and do a film for a lot less money, a lot less. So there is, so they, you know, they do one for the bank and one for their shows.
Exactly,
you know, and they do that.
Yeah.
They really do.
And when Michael Fassbender was talking to you and Dune Frank and all the rest, it's our Lenny Abramson. I mean, like, it's obvious before you even start. He knows he's not going to get what he might get for Star Trek or Star Wars.
I mean, I suppose the reason he can do, you know, he does X-Men and all that stuff is so he can do, like, Frank or Macbeth or whatever, you know, Shame or whatever.
Well, would you like to have been in that position on the other side? Like, I mean, a director, producer kind of thing of the sort of Clint Eastwood thing, where he does his Bird and all these kind of movies, which don't necessarily mean much at the box office. Then he does the huge box office because he can pay for those ones too.
Yeah.
Perfect world, isn't it?
Yeah, no,
and
it is a perfect world.
We've seen two of our biggest directors, Jim Sheridan and Neil Jordan, kind of straddling those two worlds as well, where they would do studio pictures and then be able to do the passion project here as well. It's perfect balance.
Yeah, it really is, all right, yeah. Okay, coming in under budget, over budget or whatever, you really have to make sure that this is going to happen. That's one of the biggest things of all, isn't it? That, like, you know, you don't go over budget. How do you sort of make sure that happens? Or have you ever been in a situation where, whoops, this is not going to be made, we need another 2 million, we're not going to get 2 million, the whole thing is going down this morning?
Unfortunately, I have been in that situation.
This is like a former addict speaks.
But it's not 2 million, but I have definitely been in a situation, and quite regularly, where you're heading into something and you kind of realise the ambition for this has grown, it's changed, as you know, because it changes all the time. You know, it changes when actors get on.
It's your job to keep it in check, Ed.
You know, but that's what you do, and but also it's also your job to fight for it.
If
you see that something is developing that's actually going to cost more or, you know, needs more resources, it's your job to go and fight that fight with the financiers. And I mean, you know, if actually the reason is because people, you know, aren't doing their work properly and they're not coming prepared, and that's the reason it's going over budget, it's your job to, you know, face up to that as well. So you do, but the thing is that most of the time you're kind of in a situation where they're kind of, you know, if you stay in touch with the financiers, they're pretty kind of understanding, actually, because they can, as long as you don't phone them up and say, whoops, I've just found out.
Right,
but if you're saying, look, I'm worried about this and this is happening and we're going to do this, and they're part of the decision making in a way, then when it comes to it, they'll put their hands in their pockets. You know?
Well, Gareth, what about you? Have you ever had to try to go to somebody that, like, a not film board situation and realise that, you know, I think this guy has money, he might be interested in this, we've got good actors, this blah, blah, this, I think he likes this subject matter, we'll go for it. We'll sit down with some big money bags and say, come on, you've got the money there. there, or there are tax breaks, or is there something? Give us your two or three.
Yeah, minutes. Our last project, you know, was an independent feature film, so it was made for under 100,000. So what you have in that situation is realism staring you straight in the face, because sometimes when you have the bigger budgets and other people are paying for it, you know, you access the money, it heads into the account and you run the production. Here you're at a level where every decision matters, because there is no wriggle room. It's an independent movie. You have a lot of people working on it for free at times, which is not right as well, but it's the survival of trying to get the film made. And you know, we had a financier on board in this who had given us quite a large amount of money. And so you have a direct relationship with them. So if anything goes wrong, the last thing you want to do is to go back to them and say, can I have more money? And I talked about learning on the job, and give you a prime example of that. We decided we wanted a really nice piece of music for the end credits, and that we would get an original song. And through some various different ways and means, we ended up talking to Lorena McKennett, the Canadian singer. She's quite a big artist. You know, she's sold millions around the world. And she liked the movie and she wanted to do an original song for the end of the movie. Now, this was great for us, but what it started was a whole process of me engaging with a whole amount of agents, management. Yeah. And I suddenly realized this is really hard to handle when you were a small budget movie, because it started adding legal fees before we knew it.
And you had to talk to publishers who didn't get to hoot that Lorena liked your movie.
Yeah, they did not want her to do it, but she wanted to do it. So you had this very strange dichotomy of trying to work out between all of them. And actually, that started to push the budget up, because she needed a recording studio that she wanted to do. And I'm on the other end of the phone saying, am I going to say no to her? Absolutely not. This is a treasure that she's doing the movie. And suddenly, a couple of thousand here, a couple of thousand there. And when you're at that type of level, it's very tough. And you end
also,
up.
People wouldn't necessarily know some of the stuff about music that happens in the movie. I mean, I watched Once Again, Begin Again with John Carney. And I have to say, see that last 3 seconds there? That was the whole budget of the movie. Where Ruffalo and Keira Knightley are walking down the street and they start singing one or two songs from the Great American Songbook kind of thing. So that just took, it's just the amount of things you guys can't do and would love to do in terms of lots of things in the movie, because there's no budget there to meet these publisher type people who don't give two damns about what you're trying to do. Why am I saying all this? Anyway, the point is, trying to get in on the budget is one thing. The one thing that you probably might know now that you didn't know when you were starting out, or is it one huge, big, amorphous mass of everything? Is there anything particular you say, I've definitely learned this one all right?
God, it's a big question. I think the thing that I always remember, you know, and I sort of mentioned it earlier, but is at the end of the day, the scarce resource in our business is talent. You know, it's writing and directing talent. That's the scarce resource. So I spend an awful lot more of my time trying to find things that I want to produce than I do trying to find the money to produce them. Because if you find the thing that you really want to make, I won't say it's easy, but it's a lot easier to find the money for it. Do you know what I mean? That's what I spend, you know.
Well, then what are the pros and cons of, if you like, being an independent producer here or having the backing of a big studio behind you? Do you sleep better with the latter?
I think if you go into the bigger budget studio picture, I think control will slip away very quickly, because a lot of the time the edit suite can be judged by committee. I remember talking to Gary Shore about this, who directed Dracula Untold. You know, he felt there was a lot of producers in the background, you know, and it's a $100 million movie. Rightly so. They see the marketing potential of the movie at the end and they're going to make decisions. And so for the filmmaker behind it, they might not necessarily get to envisage it the way they expected, because this pressure is there. So I think if you go with a bigger budget with the studio, you can relinquish a lot of control, but you know that a lot of people are going to see the movie.
If you go
the indie route, you can stay true to your story, but it's going, you could be looking at the Dallas Buyers Club scenario, where it's going to take 20 years to get your film to the screen.
By the way, the indie route, just as a matter of interest, a lot of people don't necessarily know, there's a film festival on somewhere every single day of the year. There's always film festivals. I get the impression that even with the stuff, the 8 major movies and the Oscars or something, all of them went through a film festival. And you go through a film festival where a lot of people are supposedly, they get extra pages in newspapers to talk about stuff, and you get a lot of free advertising, and people are really delighted they were the first to see it, midnight showing of this. It really kind of builds momentum, doesn't it?
Especially for films that don't have the marketing budgets of the studio.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, like we had, for instance, Jack Rayner's new movie, which is Glassland, was at Sundance this year.
And he won Best Jury Actor.
Yeah, he won Best Actor. So that, like, that gets you immediately oodles of, you know, coverage, and that just helps. Then we went to Berlin, where we were selling the movie. So you're kind of coming off Berlin or some off Sundance with the kind of publicity and with that notoriety and all the distributors there in Berlin, and you sell to them. So it has a really practical kind of...
And then is one of the next steps that a thing like Glassland, I don't even know if there is a big sort of production company in any way behind it at all, but is one of those things where you then go to one, in it, like a Harvey Weinstein type, and say, look what we've done here, and then his push, you can sit back and smoke that cigar.
Yeah, I mean, like, for instance, another film that we've just finished doing, which is in post at the moment, it's a film called Room, Lenny Abrahamson's new film.
Emma Dunhu.
Emma Dunhu's book, yeah. So when we were financing that, we sold it to a US distributor called A24. So that's already done in a sense, which is great because it means that they're committed to it. They have to get it out. They're now thinking about their strategy, you know, and quite often with films that we finish, we bring them to, like, Sundance. It's a classic thing. Like, The Guard was classic.
Yeah.
So you bring that. You haven't got a distributor. You're screening it, kind of world premiere. All the US distributors are in the room. It's a real make or break. It's like either it'll fly or it won't.
Okay, by the way, the story of Room as the movie, what is it?
The story of how we made it or what the subject matter is?
No, what the subject matter is.
Well, it's Emma Donoghue's book, and it's based on, very loosely based on the kind of Fritzl case. It's about...
And this is what I'm asking, very loosely based on.
Yeah.
The fact that it is, like, they can say this is inspired by true events or this is a true story or whatever. I mean, look at what's happening in the Oscars at the moment. Everything from, you know, what do you call them, the Sniper movie, American Sniper, to, like, The Theory of Everything, to, you know, the Eddie Redmayne movies, the Stephen Hawking, all this kind of stuff. All that based on true... Does that open an extra couple of doors at the moment? That seems to be a bit more... Vogue even than ever before.
It does. I mean, it does. Although what definitely works.
It's not specifically Fritzl, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, books work. Actually, that's what works. And if you can actually bring someone in, you say, well, here's a book, you know, and Emma's book had won loads of awards and it sold loads of copies. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out. Well, there's a pre-made audience for that film. Everyone who bought the book. Because, you know, if you've read a book, you're kind of curious to see the movie, you know, so you already know that there's... So it's a kind of form of market testing or something like that, you know? So I don't know in that case if it's the true life sort of connection, or I'd say it's more the book in that case.
Right, okay. Gareth, just as a matter of interest, the producer being involved in what decisions that I mightn't have thought? I mean, choosing locations for filming, maybe, or sitting down with those who do casting?
I think, yeah, locations, definitely, because obviously with the tax breaks that exist in every country, that's a huge decision to decide where you might actually set the film.
Is that why so many movies that are based in LA are made in Vancouver? So many movies here are based in Eastern Europe?
Yeah, New Orleans as well. I mean, and, you know, you've had a number of Irish movies shot in Luxembourg because of those tax breaks and co-production deals. You had Waking Ned was filmed on the Isle of Man.
Yeah, are there good tax breaks here? I mean, the film board here, obviously you're going to say they're great. Yeah, I'd love if you said, no, I hate them, they never gave me a penny.
Well, they don't have enough money. That's what I'd say. They really don't have enough money. And there are really good tax breaks here. And the government have kind of committed to this new thing. The only thing I'm worried about those tax breaks is that it will just turn Ireland into a kind of big facilities house. So we'll be flooded with big American movies and all that kind of stuff. You know, costs will go up. And smaller Irish films and television will get squeezed out. So that's the kind of concern, you know.
But did the smaller Irish films don't just happen as crumbs falling off the table? Even it doesn't work like that, no?
Not necessarily. You know, if people's attentions are diverted to something else, then that's, you know, that's where the energy goes. But I mean, in a way, for the future of the industry, what you need are things that we make here, you know, and that Irish producers and directors create, write, own, all that stuff.
And Gareth, I mean, the people you work with, or even Ed, like, you know, you just mentioned Lenny Abrahamson, and, like, you know, big stuff in terms of just what's been happening in movies in the last few years. Once a good relationship is established with a particular filmmaker, do producers like you always like going back? Really, you can't beat that.
Well, it's also, it's like, I mean, the other thing we've been doing recently is this soap for TV3, Red Rock, which has been kind of a huge enterprise for me in one way. It's a very different thing, but it's still drama. It's still, like, you know, 2.5 hours a week. And the guy who created that, Peter McKenna, it's just been such a kind of, you know, it's such a kind of an experience for everybody, you know, and such a tough experience in lots of ways. When you've had that kind of experience with somebody, you're like, and you come out the other end, of course you want to work with them, and you also know who your friends are, you know?
Yeah,
you're
exactly,
kinda like,
of course, yeah. By the way, just before we leave this, 51552 is our text if you have a question for the boys here, in terms of just, like, as I mentioned earlier on, like, some of your stuff down through the, like what Richard did, Garage. By the way, when you released that in England, you didn't call it Garage, did you? Adam and Paul, The Guard, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and as you mentioned. So when is Room coming out? When is Glassland coming out?
Glassland is going to be in April. It's at the Dublin Film Festival.
Right,
it's going to be on there at the end of this month. 27th of March.
And something like the Dublin Film Festival is huge on every level in terms of what you guys do.
Well, what's really good about the Dublin Film Festival for us is if we're releasing in April, well, then we can have our premiere at the Dublin Film Festival. They'll help us cover the cost of it. We get that attention. And yeah, so it really is helpful, yeah.
What do you think is the idea people are looking for most, do you think, Garrett, in terms of like, I mean, what you're looking for? I mean, Ed mentioned there that, you know, a book, an adapted screenplay, if you like, from that then can often be really a great route to go, whatever. Or the true story that I mentioned earlier on. What catches your attention and says, I really want to make this movie, and I think I could because I could convince other people to give me money or whatever?
I work on a different level in the sense that because sometimes I direct projects as well, if I like them, I'm always looking for something that catches me. We can only handle a small number of projects at any time. You know, Ed's company can handle quite a lot.
Ed, jack of all trades.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, the company's name is Mixbag Media, so that probably sums that up. But the, you know, I mean, I would have done a documentary on the great travel writer Dervla Murphy, things like that. These sort of passion projects that come along. But it's story. I mean, in terms of looking for a screenplay idea, if I get hit by the story and it really sucks me in, I then can actually assign that in my mind to say, I want to spend 3 years working on this.
Can I just say something really funny? Dervla Murphy stuff, fantastic, all the rest. And I've read some of the stuff. I actually visited the place in Waterford or wherever. Mm. I've never seen the movie.
Yeah, well,
now,
of course.
Like, that's the perfect example of why haven't I seen that? What was it even called?
Who is Dervla Murphy's name of it? And you'd be glad to know it's going to be re-released again because it's 50
that's
years
true.
Since Full
this,
Tilt.
This is exactly the problem I'm
Welcome
talking
to
about.
The independent
yeah,
world.
Exactly.
You know?
That sums up more of what we've been saying the last half hour than anything else.
Yeah, and literally, like, I mean, it was on TV and stuff like that as well. But you see, I think there is a slight problem. Ed referred to it there that we should keep making Indigenous movies. We've been bad at getting Irish movies, Irish television programs to the forefront of schedules, to basically embrace them, to, you know, question national identity, to look at things. You know, we really need to get to a stage now where audiences will accept and start going to Irish movies a lot more as well, and that it builds it up, because that's the way that it will back up the industry. And the likes of Love, Hate and everything have done wonders for, you know, Irish drama. We need more of it.
Well, 5 or 6 years' time, 100 years since War of Independence and all the rest of it, A Nightingale Falling, what's happened?
It did well. I mean, it lasted 6 weeks at the box office, which was unheard of for a movie of that scale. And we've actually sold to South Korea, to Germany, to the States. So, I mean, for us, it was a small project, but it's actually made its production budget back and everything,
I was going to say, what advice would you have for any budding producers out there? But I know what the advice is. Just believe in what you do and go for it and shut up, for God's sake. Okay, so listen, just one thing again, Ed. What do you call it? Room is going to be released when, did you say, do you think?
It'll be probably this autumn. We don't have a date yet, but probably it'll back to the festival, so we'll finish it probably sometime in the summer, and it'll appear in one of the autumn festivals, Toronto or Telluride or Venice, assuming we get
it. And who's starring in it?
It's Brie Larson, who's recently in The Gambler. Joan Allen and William H. Macy playing her parents, basically.
Oh, really?
So,
okay.
Great
she
cast.
Joan Allen played Veronica Guerin in the first of the two.
She did, she's a great actress. Yeah.
All right, well, listen, look, Ed, thank you very much indeed. Ed Guiney, it is. Garrett Daly also. Thank you both, folks. And if there's any websites, I'm sure you can find out lots of questions you can ask them after this, because we've had enough of it now in the last 20 minutes. Thank you, guys.